All right. Last week I started talking about Jesus' radical countercultural message of hope. We looked at three stories last week. The first story that we looked at was a man born blind in John 9. And what was really interesting about that passage is in their cultural paradigm, the only explanation that they could come up with is that somebody must have sinned. Either the man or his parents must have sinned, and that's why this poor man is blind. And Jesus comes along and says, no, it has nothing to do with anyone's sin. This happens so that the work of God might be put on display in this man's life. And what a radical message of hope that was for that culture in that day and how it stood against anything that they believed. Then we also looked at the story of the widow in Luke 7 who had a dead son, and they're carrying the son out in the funeral procession. And we talked about how the culture of the day would have said that this woman is now without hope. There was no one to care for her, and that this would have been her own death sentence in a sense. But Jesus comes along and says, no, in the midst of this, and we talked about the culture of mourning and weeping that they had, and Jesus says, don't weep. And then he raises the son from the dead and gives her back to her. And then finally, last week, we looked at the story in Luke 13 of the woman who had been crippled for 18 years. And again, their paradigm would not have seen any change coming to that condition, and they would have condemned and shunned the woman and probably blamed her for having sin. But we looked about how that she was already in the temple, and so religious practice wasn't going to get her free from this infirmity because she was already in the temple. But Jesus comes along and just touches her, and she's healed. Well, today I want to continue to look at this incredible, radical, countercultural message of hope that Jesus brings. The stories that we're going to look at today all have a little bit different nuance to them. They're going to bring a little bit something different to this message of Jesus' hope. So today I want to start by looking at another story of a man that was crippled for a very long time, and this story is in John 5. So if you have one of the green sheets, it's on there. John 5, starting in verse 1, says this. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. Now there in Jerusalem, near the sheep gate, I can't read today, wow. Near the sheep gate at the pool, which is in Aramaic, is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was, of course, a Sabbath. And so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It's the Sabbath. The law forbids you from carrying your mat." Well, as always, let's start with looking at the culture and the background to understand what it is that Jesus does and how his message of hope stands against the culture of the day. Obviously, there were no hospitals or doctors in this day and age. There was nowhere for this man to go get treatment. Now, this pool at Bethesda was basically the closest thing that they had to a hospital. And what the tradition was is that periodically an angel would come and stir the waters in the pool, and then the first person to get into the water after the angel had stirred it would be healed. And so that's the tradition, and that's why this man is sitting there in the hope that the angel will stir and somehow he'll be the first one in. But if it's up to being the first one in the water, that automatically means that the most able-bodied people there would get in first. So this man was at a severe disadvantage because apparently he's unable to move on his own. So let's take a look at the hopelessness that would have existed in this situation for this man. Verse 3 says that there were many others waiting. The chances of him being the first one in the water didn't exist. Because there are all kinds of people waiting at this pool. This man's not getting in first. Verse 5 then tells us that he had been an invalid for 38 years. That's a really long time. Verse 7, it says that he didn't have anyone to help him get into the water, which means he couldn't move on his own. But it also means that he's alone. He has no family. There are no friends there to help him. He's completely alone. The culture of the day would have said that this man had no hope and would spend the rest of his days as an invalid by the side of this pool. But then Jesus comes along, and Jesus has a different message. First, it says that Jesus notices the man. Remember, from all three stories that we looked at last week, Jesus always notices the people who are hurting and in desperate situations. In all three stories that we looked at last week, Jesus noticed the person, and it says it here again. But this time, Jesus does something different. Jesus asks the question, but it's a question of hope. He says, "Do you want to get well?" The man's response, though, was one of culture and tradition. Jesus asks a question of hope, but the man responds with culture and tradition. The only paradigm that he had for healing was to somehow get into the pool. So he quickly makes an excuse as to why he hasn't been healed. First, he says, "There's no one to help me." Then he says, "Everyone else gets in front of me." The problem is, this same type of thinking still exists today. This story helps us to see the different negative ways people can respond to Jesus' message of hope. So I want to give you a few examples so you can understand what I mean. Sometimes people will so identify with their illness that they can't see themselves healed. "But I have cancer." When you go to pray for them, "But I have cancer. I have this, I have that." Their identity has become their illness, their diagnosis. It's literally who they are. They have no paradigm that anything could change that. They have no hope. I think we see a little of that here with this man. "There's no one to help me. My only hope is to get in the water. These other people are all getting in the water before me." He immediately, when he's asked the question of hope, he goes to making excuses as to why not. But don't we sometimes do that? Immediately, our first response is the why not, the excuse, the blame. But as you remember from last week, Jesus' message always came with action and power. The fact that he had been an invalid for 38 years didn't matter to Jesus. So whatever it is that we're affected with today, cancer, MS, it doesn't matter. Jesus is not intimidated by our illness. But to receive Jesus' message of hope and the accompanying healing, we must put aside our identity as an ill person and replace it with the countercultural message of hope. Another thing that we see today, and we see in this passage, is making excuses. He is certainly making an excuse, but it also seems like he's blaming others, right? First he says, "There's no one to help me." Then he says, "But these people get in before me." So he makes an excuse, and he blames someone else for why he can't get healed. But this type of thinking has kept him in bondage for 38 years. So it's not working. But I wonder what would happen if he changed his thinking. Rather than blaming others, saying there's no one to help me or they get in first, what if he'd switched to asking others for help? "Will you please stay with me and help me get in the water?" Surely after 38 years, a kind person would have come along and helped him get in the water. But as long as his attitude is one of blame, he remains in bondage. And I see this all the time with people who are ill. "I have this condition because of someone else. Someone did this to me. Someone is keeping me this way." I had a conversation this week where someone was suffering from serious illness and they were blaming someone else for their illness. Really? I don't think so. Jesus' message of hope is not contingent upon the actions or inactions of someone else. His message of hope and subsequent action and power are between you and him. So the blame game, the making excuses, holds no water. And another one that we see frequently, we don't see it in this passage, but it happens so often I have to mention it, is false humility. There are others who are worse off than me. Go pray for them. I'm okay. This is a false humility tied to a wrong view of Jesus' cross and his message of hope. Jesus' message of hope is so countercultural that it's big enough for everybody. Because you see, what's happening is when we say, oh, I'm okay, there's people worse off than me, what we're really saying is, I think Jesus' ability is limited, and I don't want to waste that limited ability on me, so go heal someone else. But his message of hope is so radical and so countercultural, it is without limits, and so it is for everyone. It doesn't matter if you have a hangnail and the person next to you is about to die from something really horrible. Jesus' healing is limitless. And so for us to say, well, there's people worse off than me, is discrediting the cross. It's saying, Jesus, your work wasn't big enough for all of us, and so now I'm going to be holier than thou and meter out your grace. But his message really is big enough for all of us. But then, as I mentioned last week, there's always this action and power. His message of hope is always followed by action and power. None of the excuses matter to Jesus. He simply says to this man, get up. And the man is healed. This was completely countercultural to anything the people of the day had ever seen before. This healing is good news on so many levels. The man's lack of faith didn't matter. It didn't matter that his cultural paradigm only allowed for healing as if he could get in the water. That didn't matter. It didn't matter that he had blamed others and made excuses. Jesus healed him anyway, because that's who Jesus is. And that's how countercultural his message of hope really is. But that's good news for many of us who have thought or acted or been this same way. Now, I do want to make a little side note here. Yes, Jesus healed this man despite what he may have done or what he may have thought and his lack of faith. But that doesn't give us license to stay in that same place. It will go much better for us, and our healings will come much faster if we give up that identity of being an ill person, if we give up our identity of being our sickness, if we stop the blame game and stop making excuses and stop having false humility. The key is to put aside all of that junk and receive Jesus for who he is and what he's done on the cross. But now there's another subtle message in this particular healing story. The ones that we looked at last week, one of those stories happened on a Sabbath. And so Jesus got into trouble for healing on the Sabbath. And we made the comment that Jesus is more than willing to shatter religious norms and traditions to deliver hope and healing. But in this passage today, it also happens on a Sabbath. But the man gets in trouble this time, because the Pharisees come and say, it's against the law to carry your mat. When Jesus comes with his message of hope, the people around us who don't get it will mock you. They'll ridicule you. They'll make up a law. Jesus doesn't heal anymore. You're a nutcase. Right? Are you willing to look foolish to receive a message of hope that is completely counter to the culture that we live in? Because just like this man got in trouble for carrying his mat, when we really follow Jesus for who he is, the people of the world that don't get it will make fun of us. Now, last week, with each of the stories that we looked at, I tried to include an example of someone that I have known personally or prayed for personally who was healed, and the situation was very, very similar to the one that we saw in the biblical story. I have over the years prayed for a number of people in really desperate situations and living with long-term chronic illnesses, the kinds of things that culture would definitely say wouldn't go away. These weren't headaches where you can take an aspirin and the headache's going to go away. And some of these people that I have prayed for, they couldn't see themselves any other way. They simply could not get a vision for what their life would look like if they were healed. Now, for some of those people, Jesus healed them anyway, because it doesn't matter. And for others, they clung to that identity so tightly that they just couldn't receive a healing. I remember one story in particular. I was praying for a woman who had had a knee injury. And so I just, you know, put my knee right on, or my hand right under her kneecap when I'm praying for her knee. And maybe after just like a minute of praying, she just blurts out, "But I'm not worthy." You see, she had that false humility, that false view of the cross. That's the point. We're not worthy. If we have to work ourselves to the point of being worthy to receive from Jesus, then his cross is a sham. None of us are worthy. It doesn't matter what our affliction is. It doesn't matter what we've done in the past or what we'll do in the future. It doesn't matter how holy we are or are not. His healing will come because of who he is and what he did on the cross. It has nothing to do with who we are. And so to say, "I'm not worthy," is ultimately a rejection of the grace of his cross. And so I changed the way I was praying for her. I stopped praying for the knee and I just started praying for her heart, that she could receive who Jesus is in the fullness. And ultimately, I believe that's really what Jesus was after that night. Jesus was a lot less concerned about that knee as he was about the condition of her heart and her ability to receive him fully. I remember another time praying for a man that I don't remember the chronic illness. I want to say maybe it was MS, but I'm not sure. And he was also going blind. And so I'm praying for him. And I'm praying for the blind. I figure I'll go for the blindness because that'll be real obvious. He'll know if he got healed from that, right? But I'm also praying for the MS, and I would, you know, do the Vineyard prayer model. I'd pray for him a little bit and then ask him, "How you feeling? Is there any difference? Do you feel anything?" And he would respond the same every time, "But I have MS. I know you have MS, but I'm praying. Are you noticing? But I have MS." And that was where it ended. After about six or seven times of that, I'm like, "Well, sir, blessings." He could never get to the point where he could understand that Jesus could overcome even something like MS and blindness. There was no breakthrough for him that night. I hope that somewhere, sometime else, he was able to receive that. Now, I want to transition to a different passage. I had several passages in mind that I wanted to look at that in regards to hope. But one morning, I just kind of paused, and I said, "Lord, what other passages really speak of your countercultural message of hope?" And this was the first passage that came to mind, and it kind of surprised me at first. I'm like, "Really?" But then as I began to look at it, I went, sure enough, the message of hope doesn't get any more radical than it does in this story. And it's the story of Zacchaeus in Luke 19. So all the other stories that we've looked at so far included a healing of some sort, or the one story last week was a raising from the dead. But this story, there's no healing, at least not a physical healing. But Luke 19, starting in verse 1, says this: "Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, 'Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today.' So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, 'He has gone to be the guest of a sinner.' But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, 'Look, Lord, here and now, I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay it back four times.' Jesus said to him, 'Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost.'" Again, let's start by understanding a little bit of the background and the culture. Verse 2 tells us that he was both a chief tax collector and a wealthy man. This worked against him in a really big way. Ironically, by the way, the name Zacchaeus means clean or innocent one. Now, the Romans and even some local authorities would license, they would impose various taxes on the people, and then they would license other people to collect those taxes. Okay? So the Romans didn't actually go out in the street and collect the taxes themselves. Somewhere off in Rome, somebody would say, we need to collect this amount of tax, and then they would sell a licensing agreement, sort of like what we have today, for someone to go collect that tax. So Zacchaeus, as a chief tax collector, has one of these licenses, and so then he has hired other people as a chief tax collector. He has people that are working for him to actually go out and to collect the taxes as well. But there was a catch, because the Romans didn't care how much you added to the tax as your commission, as long as they got their tax. And so there were sometimes some pretty arbitrary commissions assigned to these taxes. That is presumably how it is that Zacchaeus became so wealthy, because he is charging a commission on the taxes that he's collecting, and then he's keeping that commission for himself. But even worse than that is, you see, the Jews hated the fact that they were under Roman oppression, and they hated the Roman taxes. So they hated, despised the tax collectors, because this was an affront to the sovereignty of their nation, which was obviously lost at this point. But then it gets even worse for Zacchaeus, because he's a Jew. And so for the rest of the Jews, they would have looked at him and seen him as a traitor. You have betrayed our nation by collecting this tax for this hideous pagan nation that is oppressing us. So in the culture and the society of their day, they didn't get any lower than Zacchaeus. He was scum. He was pond scum, because he was scalping them and he was a traitor. Yeah. So he would have been largely ostracized because he was a traitor, because he was collecting taxes, but there was also this culture that existed in that day and age of the necessity of generosity. You see, if a fellow Jew was in need, you had an obligation to be generous to him. That culture actually lives on today in Africa quite well. So because he was wealthy, that probably meant that he wasn't being generous either. He wasn't living up to the traditional cultural Jewish tradition. So he's probably lower than Ponscum. But Jesus comes along, and Jesus sees him. It says he notices the man. So the other four stories with the healing, it says that Jesus noticed the man. They were all in really, really desperate situations. They were blind, they were invalid, they were crippled. In one case, the young boy was dead. Here's a very wealthy man. But he's a social outcast. He is on the very, very fringes of society. But Jesus notices him. It doesn't matter that he was a social outcast. Jesus' message of hope is even for those on the fringes of society. Jesus not only notices him, he calls him by name, which is a prophetic word. It shows love, it shows the connection, it shows the deep connection, the heart-level connection that Jesus had with this man. Zacchaeus, come down out of that tree. I need to stay at your house today. In fact, it says in the Greek, it is necessary for me to stay at your house. A very strong statement. The man who'd only wished to have a glimpse. Remember, it just said that he wanted to see who this Jesus was. That little tiny bit of faith ends up getting him a house guest of Jesus. But according to the culture of the day, this was not a cool thing for Jesus to do. Verse 7 makes it very clear that the people there were quite displeased with Jesus' decision to go stay at this man's house. He is going to stay in the house of a sinner. This did not fit their cultural norm. Eating with someone in their home carried great significance, great social value in that day. And for a Pharisee To go and to eat with a notorious sinner was scandalous, but it would have made him unclean, and it would have led to his own social ostracism. So if a Pharisee goes into the house of the sinner, he's now equal to the sinner and will be shunned by the rest of society. But that doesn't matter to Jesus. He doesn't care what the culture says. He's willing to take his message of hope into those places where others wouldn't go. So for Jesus, going to Zacchaeus' house was a big deal. But what he was saying is, I accept this person, even though in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of the crowd, it's like I'm touching a leper. But Zacchaeus responds. There's a real irony in Luke, because this is Luke chapter 19. Previous to it, in Luke chapter 18, there was a rich young ruler that comes to Jesus and says, how do I get saved? And Jesus says, well, sell all your belongings and come follow me. And it says the rich young ruler went away disappointed, because he wasn't about to sell all his belongings. And so here in chapter 19, we have this stark contrast where we've just come away from that story, and here Zacchaeus offers up everything, and he hasn't even been asked. Jesus never says, give me your money or pay back what you owe. He never says that. Zacchaeus' response is immediate to it. It appears if he didn't even need much time to think about it. For whatever reason, the lure and the power that money had over the rich young ruler didn't have here with Zacchaeus, because he could receive this radical, countercultural message of hope. Now, it doesn't say it in the text, but it appears that the crowd suddenly shifts from the sycamore tree to Zacchaeus' home. They've made it to his home, and the crowd would have followed him. That would have been the tradition of the day. If you were having an important dinner or banquet, anybody in town would have just come to your home and peered in the windows. There were no creepers back then. It was just the way it was. You know, they would just come peer in your windows and watch the banquet, and that was the socially accepted norm of the day. And so the crowd follows, and they're all peeking in the windows to see what is Jesus going to do with this sinner. And he says he's going to give half of what he has to the poor, and he's going to pay back anyone that he has cheated four times. The man has just given away all of his wealth. The message of Jesus, his counterculture of message of hope, was so radical, it changed Zacchaeus instantly, and money didn't matter anymore. Then Jesus says that salvation has even come. Now, what happened here? He's a tax collector, he's a traitor, he's a cheat, he's ungenerous. Jesus says, Zacchaeus, come down out of the tree. I'm going to stay at your house. And all of a sudden, Zacchaeus is giving away all of his wealth, and he's saved. The only difference between this Zacchaeus and this Zacchaeus was that gentle heart love, that gentle, radical message of hope that Jesus brings. Sometimes we make this too difficult, don't we? Sometimes we think we have to convince people, we have to argue with them. But they really just need a message of hope. They just really need to see Jesus for who he really is. You know, as I think about an example of this today, some of you may remember the movie Furious Love that we showed here at the church a couple years ago. Darren Wilson, the producer of the movie, actually came and spoke at our church too. And in Furious Love, I don't remember the guy's name. I think it was Matthias Vandersteen, but I'm not 100% sure. He had gone to, I believe it was Africa, to preach in a modern-day leper colony. This is a story that happened 5 years ago. And he felt like he was supposed to go to this leper colony and just to preach, right? So he gets there, and he's up front, and he's preaching. And he feels the Holy Spirit kind of tap him on the shoulder and say, stop preaching. And if it was Matthias, he says, why? I've come here to do this. And the Holy Spirit's like, no, I just want you to hug them. And so Matthias stops preaching and he gets down off the stage and he just begins to hug the lepers. Now remember, leprosy is insanely contagious. And as he hugs each one, they give their life to the Lord. And they all said the same thing. We've never seen such an unconditional expression of love before. That a wealthy white European would come hug us, poor African lepers. And they gave their lives to Jesus just because Matthias brought a simple message of hope that was countercultural. Rich, white Europeans don't go to Africa and hug lepers. When I was in Africa, I would see the same thing, but to a lesser degree. They would come up to me and say, "Are you French?" Because Senegal used to be a French colony. I mean, no. "Are you German? Are you British?" "No." "Where are you from?" "I'm from America." And they would be like, "There's an American in Senegal? Why?" "I've come to tell you guys about Jesus." And they would listen just because it was so countercultural for them to see an American, a rich white American, in Senegal. Americans don't go to Senegal. That is a dark, nasty place. But it's just a simple countercultural message of hope. Well, as I look at this story of Zacchaeus, I think there are two possible traps for us to fall into, two lessons we should learn from this story. First, there is going to be that tendency, that trap, to become like the crowd in the passage and to judge others to be sinners or social outcasts. To think that a person is too far, they're too far apart, they're too different, they're too on the fringe. But when we say that, what we're really saying is that same sense of false humility of, oh, go heal someone else. When we say that person is too far gone, they're too far on the fringe of society, what we're really saying is the cross of Jesus isn't big enough for both of us. And then on the really dirty, sinful part of us, what we're saying is, don't make me uncomfortable. But Jesus did not call us to a life of comfort. He said, go, make disciples of all nations. You're going to have to leave your comfort zone to go make disciples of all nations. And so we cannot stand here and think that somehow the cross is too small to reach the people on the outskirts of our own society, and we cannot think that somehow our life was meant to be always comfortable. Or secondly, and perhaps even more dangerously, we may fall into the trap of thinking that Jesus couldn't possibly accept me, that I am Zacchaeus, that my life is the one of Zacchaeus. Remember, tax collectors were probably lower than pond scum. This message is in the Bible for a reason. The Lord put it on my mind this week for a reason, because there are people that think Jesus' message of hope is great for others, but it can't possibly be for me. There's something inherently wrong with me, so Jesus can't possibly save me. Or I've done too many bad things. I've sinned. Too many bad things have happened to me. I'm the wrong color. It doesn't matter. As soon as we begin to think that it can't possibly be for me, we've once again completely discredited his cross. His sacrifice, his work on the cross, absolutely, positively, 100% has to be for anybody or it's for nobody. There's no gray area here. It's either for everybody or it's for nobody. His message of hope is for you, no matter what culture might say about you. We must not only receive this message for ourselves, but we must take this message of hope to the Zacchaeuses of the world. They're all around us. Really, we have to internalize this. We have to understand that it is for us. And then we need to go and make disciples of all nations. Said somewhat tongue-in-cheek, maybe we need to go visit an IRS office. I don't know. But there are people around us who are on the edges of culture. You know, we've had this relationship with this, it's a non-alcoholic bar for people in recovery called The Other Side. And I've been hanging out there as much as I could. And you get asked the question a lot, what are you doing here? Why are you here? Because they've not received. You see, when you come through an addiction, there's a reason you got addicted. There's the shame of the addiction. And then there's the scandal of having been addicted. And so you're countercultural. You're on the edges of society a lot of times because people will look at you and think that there's something wrong with you. And for us to show up there and say, no, hey, we love you, man. It's a radical countercultural message of hope. It's really easy to do. But this is what he's called us to. Who's in? Let's stand.